well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We've got Representative Andrew Klein joining us here in just a moment, talking about his letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi, which I believe has 30 other signatories from the House, encouraging / demanding that the DOJ recognize the intent of Congress when it comes to the National Firearms Act. You know, as part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the $200 stamp, or the, excuse me, the $200 tax on NFA items, suppressors, short-barreled firearms, has been undone as of January the 1st. But the registration requirement remains, not because of what Congress did, but because of what the Senate parliamentarian did. Remember, in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the House passed a version that repealed the $200 tax stamp and registration requirement on suppressors. They couldn't get short-barreled firearms added in there, but the Senate did. So both the tax and the registration requirement were undone by the One Big Beautiful Bill Act for, again, most NFA items, not machine guns. But then the Senate parliamentarian came back and said, well, no, you can use the reconciliation process to get rid of the tax, but not the registration requirement, because that's policy. Even though, as Representative Clyde and others have explained, the registration is actually a registry of who's paid the tax. So how do you even comply with that? It is odd. But in the meantime, the DOJ has continued to defend the NFA, both the $200 tax and the registration requirements in court cases. And this is something that Clyde and other Congress members want to see change. So we had a great conversation with the Congressman about this very issue. Take a look and a listen. Representative Clyde, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to talk to you, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Cam. Great to be with you.
Absolutely. And thank you for your efforts and the efforts of your colleagues there on Capitol Hill to try to get the executive branch aligned with the legislative branch when it comes to the provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the National Firearms Act, more generally speaking. You know, just to give our audience a little bit of background, in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, the House had included language that would have repealed the $200 tax and the registration requirements on suppressors and short-barreled firearms, correct? And any other weapons as well, I believe, right?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. The House included those for suppressors. It included eliminating the $200 tax. It included eliminating all the registration. It included a preemption to the states as well. You know, if they said, hey, if it's registered with the federal government, then, you know, it's fine with us. But once it's no longer registered with the federal government, you know, we can't have that issue come up again in the states. And so we had all that in the House bill that went over to the Senate. I tried very hard to get all the short barrels in there as well, but we had a member here in Congress that just wouldn't, on one of the committees of a jurisdiction, that wouldn't go along with it. And so he held that up, but that's okay. He ended up voting against the One Big Beautiful Bill anyway. And so, you know, that's kind of the way things happen sometimes. But it went over to the Senate, and we advocated very, very strongly with the number of senators there to ensure that short barrels got added in on the Senate side. And literally, it was beautiful what I initially saw from the Senate. I mean, they literally had everything we had asked for. And then the Senate parliamentarian struck the registration aspect, saying that that's policy. Well, it's not policy, because the registration and the taxation are inseparably linked. And yeah, you can go all the way back to, I think, like 1937, 1938, to the court's decision there that said the only reason the National Firearms Act is actually legitimate, and the only reason it survives a constitutional challenge, is because of the power of Congress to tax. And they can tax, and therefore this registry is actually a registry of the tax, it's a tax registry of the tax paid on the firearm by the serial number of the firearm. That's how they account, you know, how they account for the tax. And well, once the tax is gone, then the entire foundation is eliminated. Well, what are you going to register? You can't register a tax, and it's not a gun registry per se. It's a tax registry. So therefore, with no tax, there's no registry. And that's the whole point here. And you know, the Senate parliamentarian just, you know, that didn't click with her, unfortunately. You know, she's a Democrat put in by the senior senator from Nevada. And personally, I think she should be fired. And I think John Thune would do himself a favor in doing that and get someone that actually looks at the law or looks at the regulations in the Senate in a nonpartisan way. But be that how it is, you know, this is what we're dealing with right now.
Right.
So I wanted to ensure, because of GOA's lawsuit going forward to suing the ATF and the Department of Justice, suing the administration, to ensure that they come out with the decision that eliminates the registration, because there's no foundation for registration anymore when there's no tax. And that was the whole point.
I mean, in fact, you know, starting on January 1st, the tax goes away, right? So, is it even possible to comply with that registration requirement? Again, if you're not paying the tax, what is there to register? I think this opens, this is a huge can of worms. I think you're absolutely right about the Senate parliamentarian not understanding this or not caring what the implications are. Because, you know, I would worry, okay, so I buy a suppressor on January the 2nd. I don't have to pay a $200 tax, which means I don't have to register the tax that I didn't pay. But am I technically going to be in violation of the NFA? Could a future administration pursue criminal charges against me? I mean, how does this work in practice?
Well, I mean, as of right now, and things haven't changed yet, okay?
Right.
But as of right now, on January 2nd, you know, you go buy a suppressor, you're not going to pay the tax, but you still have to fill out the ATF registration forms, okay? So that's the way it is as we speak right now, all right? That's the way the ATF is, you know, that's their, quote, guidance, I guess, although I have given them different guidance. And this letter that I wrote that 30 of my colleagues signed onto was very pointed in giving them further guidance, congressional intent, and to tell the Department of Justice exactly where Congress stood. All right. Senate parliamentarian can't do that. They can't tell. They can't say what the intent of the legislation is. But we in Congress certainly can, and we will. And we did. And that's exactly what happened with this letter. I sent it to Pam Bondi. Not only did I send that letter, did we send it through official channels, but I sent it to her personally. And so literally within a day of that letter going out, the Department of Justice, they said, well, because the letter went out on Veterans Day, which is kind of interesting, kind of cool. You know, we veterans protect our liberty. And this was a way of protecting liberty. That Thursday, the DOJ was supposed to respond with their legal briefing, but they postponed it. They asked for a postponement for 7 days. And I think our letter had an immediate effect on that. And therefore, I think they are reevaluating exactly what their legal position is going to be, because I had some conversations with them and said, hey, where is your constitutional justification now? Because you now have a registry that is not based on any congressional power. There's no taxation here. So where there's no taxation, how can you register a tax? And so they're dealing with that. And you know, I'm an eternal optimist, and I'm hopeful that they will see the way that we wrote it and the intent here, and that they will eliminate both the taxation and the registration. And basically, I'm hoping that on January 1st, when you go in and buy a suppressor, it will be purchased just like any handgun will be purchased.
Well, I am hopeful that that is the case as well. As you say, I mean, this would take a change in direction on the part of DOJ, right? I mean, in addition to the ATF's interpretation of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, you know, more broadly, the DOJ has been defending the NFA in courts, right? They've defended the NFA regulation of suppressors. They've noted that the One Big Beautiful Bill Act removes the tax, but they even called the Solicitor General D. John Sauer called the tax a modest burden on the exercise of Second Amendment rights, and I guess the registration would be a modest burden as well. Is there a way for the DOJ to respond positively to your letter and then continue to take that position in other court cases? Or is this really a gut check moment for the DOJ when it comes to defending the NFA as it's written?
Well, I think this is certainly a gut check moment. It's a constitutional moment, that's for certain. And they need to comply with congressional intent. They don't make law, we do. All right. And we have made law and we are giving them direction. And if they think any different, then they need to read the law. All right. And that we enacted in the One Big Beautiful Bill. I think it's very clear. And if I have to go to the point of opening that letter back up where we had 30 of my colleagues sign on to it with me, and we go and get the rest of the Republicans to sign on to it, and we go over to the Senate side and make the letter bicameral and have the senators sign on to it too, I think that would be incredibly powerful. And I don't think any administration, and then after we do that, then submit it into the congressional record to do it on the House floor, all right, and have a number of us speak about it. I don't think there's any way in the world that the Department of Justice can say anything different than exactly what the letter said, and that is that the registration must be eliminated for all zero tax firearms.
Again, I mean, that clearly was the intent, right? That was what the House intended. That was what the Senate intended. It was not what the Senate parliamentarian intended, but she doesn't write the law. She doesn't have a lawmaking authority.
And she don't vote on it either.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So you say that you think there's been this sort of immediate response in terms of DOJ holding off on filing legal briefs, but you have not heard directly from the Attorney General or anybody within the DOJ specifically about the letter. Is that right?
I have not had a response yet.
Okay.
To the letter. I expect that their response will come on Thursday when they file their brief. It would be nice for them to give me a heads up and say, hey, this is what we're going to do. In fact, I may actually ask for that and just say, hey, what have you decided? Where are you going? What direction are you going? Because that's going to determine the direction I go. You know, do I open this letter back up and make it more forceful? And I will, happy to let them know that because this is our intent and we make law and the Department of Justice should follow our intent and the plain reading of the legislation, which says zero tax, which means zero congressional authority, which means zero registration of a tax that no longer exists. So, of course, the question becomes, well, what happens to those that are already registered, that have been registered for the last 91 years? Okay, what happens to that database? And we've got an appropriation coming up, a Commerce, Justice, Science appropriation. I happen to be on the Appropriations Committee. I happen to be on the Subcommittee for Commerce, Justice, Science that creates the appropriation and the budget for the Department of Justice. And so I will tell you that there in that appropriation, we have more direction for the Department of Justice, and it's my full intent to get in that Commerce Justice appropriation because I will also be on the conference committee. The conference is between the House and the Senate, and I will be working to ensure that language is in there that says that particular registry, all right, needs to be destroyed.
Wow, that would be a great step. Representative, absolutely, it would be. So when do you expect to start work on that bill?
We're working on it right now.
Okay. Okay.
And I believe that we will have it, the current continuing resolution goes through January the 30th. That gives us funding for the government, for the entire government. Now, we also did the three Republican appropriations, and people need to hear that too. Not only was this shut down a zero win for the Democrats, all right, they got nothing out of it, but it was a huge win for Republicans because we passed three Republican appropriations that since I've been in Congress in 5 years, we've never passed a Republican appropriation, but we just passed three of them, and we got nine more to work on, and one of them is going to be Commerce, Justice, Science. And in that bill, I will be working as hard as I possibly can to ensure that we have all the direction the Department of Justice needs to follow the Second Amendment and to comply with shall not be infringed. You know, you said that well, I can't remember who you actually said made the comment that, well, it's a marginal infringement, the $200 is a marginal burden, I guess. Yeah. You said. Well, excuse me, that's an infringement. Think about that $200 burden on a short-barreled shotgun that costs $400. That's a 50% tax. All right. In 1934, silencers were $6.50. You add a $200 tax on a $6.50 item. Let's put that in modern day terms. Go out to Starbucks and buy yourself a $6.50 latte. All right. Now, what if the government added a $200 tax to that $6.50 latte? Would you be buying any? No.
Well, and as you well know, Representative, we've got Democrats who say, you know, the NFA taxes haven't changed since the 1930s. We should jack them up to $5,000, $6,000 an item. Right. So, you know, you're absolutely right. A $200, add on to the purchase of a suppressor or, you know, any firearm, it's not a modest burden, as the Solicitor General suggested. But again, the whole taxation scheme is also open to further abuses by anti-gun politicians who would love to jack that up to make it, you know, completely out of the range of most Americans to purchase these items that the Trump administration acknowledges are protected by the Second Amendment, at least when it comes to suppressors. They've taken that position.
That's exactly right. You know, taxation on a constitutional right is a four-lane freeway. It's an autobahn to eliminating that constitutional right. Chief Justice John Marshall in 1819 said the power to tax includes the power to destroy. If you can tax something, you can destroy it. If you can tax it legitimately just a little bit, just like what we're seeing in the NFA, the $5 tax for the AOW, all right, or the $200 tax. You know, back in 1934, $200 was a huge amount of money. It's not so much today, but it's still a huge burden. If you can tax it a little bit, you can tax it a lot. You can tax it, and you can tax that particular inalienable right out of existence. And then it's no longer an individual constitutional right. But the Heller decision of 2008 specifically, you know, declared or recognized, it recognized that the Second Amendment is a unalienable constitutional right given to us by our creator, just like the Declaration of Independence says. You know, it is part of the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, those guarantees that are God-given, and the Second Amendment is part of liberty. It's what protects liberty. The Second Amendment protects the First Amendment, all right? And so, therefore, it has its own, you know, clause, shall not be infringed, its own protection clause. And I'm sorry, but a $200 tax is an infringement.
Absolutely. Representative Andrew Clyde, I can speak with you about Second Amendment issues all afternoon, sir, but I know you got to get back to work. I appreciate you taking a few minutes out of your day.
Thank you.
I was up in D.C. a few days ago during the shutdown. I wanted to go by Capitol Hill and say hi and shake your hand. But, you know, unfortunately, the Democrats got in the way of that. But, you know, next time I'm up in D.C., I try to stay away as much as I can. But the next time I'm up that way, I'll give you a heads up. I'd love to actually meet you in person. But always enjoy having you on the show. Look forward to doing this again very soon. And maybe we can actually touch base sometime next week and see if there has been, talk about the DOJ's response in that brief, but also see if you've heard from Attorney General Bondi herself or anybody from DOJ about the letter.
Would love to talk to you as soon as we possibly can. You're always welcome here in D.C. My office is 445 Cannon. That stands for four more years of 45. At the office for 3 years now. So it's my favorite president, my favorite caliber.
Representative Andrew Clyde, thank you so much. I look forward to doing this again very soon.
Thanks, Cam.
My thanks to Congressman Clyde for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again, whether it is next week or shortly after the Thanksgiving holiday. But we will definitely keep in touch, and he will be joining us before long. Before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, we should also note that Donald Trump has nominated Robert Sakata to be the permanent director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, that nomination made public today. Sakata is currently the deputy director of the ATF. I'm kind of surprised that that President Trump went with an ATF, let's say, institutionalist rather than an outsider, as we have seen with, you know, so many agencies and departments. Donald Trump has sort of, you know, brought in members of his inner circle those who he's got a history with. For whatever reason, we don't know why, at this point anyway, President Trump decided to stick with somebody who has been at the ATF since 2005, been at the ATF headquarters since 2013. Sukata was named deputy director back in April when Army Secretary Dan Driscoll was named the interim or acting ATF director after Kash Patel stepped down. And Sukata, along with Assistant Director Robert Leiter, who was doing double duty as a law professor at George Mason's Antonin Scalia School of Law, I think now is officially at ATF full time. He specialized in Second Amendment issues when he was at George Mason. The two of them have been working to review and undo a lot of the Biden era rules. So we have seen the demise, for instance, of the zero tolerance policy that treated paperwork errors as reason to revoke FFLs. The pistol brace rule was undone, not through the ATF, but because DOJ decided not to appeal a court decision that found the rule violated the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act. We have been told that the engaged in the business rule that treats almost every private sale of a firearm as if it should be conducted by a federally licensed firearms dealer, that too is undergoing review, but we have not seen a formal repeal. And then there have been other, I would say, smaller technical changes that the ATF has announced over the past couple of months that have been beneficial to gun owners, certainly, and to the firearms industry. In fact, the NSSF, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, was very positive when Sakata was named deputy director. They described him as somebody whose law enforcement focus has been on combating violent crime, and not somebody who has been interested in combating the Second Amendment rights of American citizens. Somebody who, you know, knows the firearms industry and is willing to work with the firearms industry, but not treat it as an enemy, which I think will go a long way towards getting the support of Republican senators when Sakata comes up for a confirmation hearing. Democrats, I expect, are going to be opposed for those very reasons. But frankly, Democrats, I think, would be opposed to anybody that Donald Trump nominated. It's going to be interesting to see where Second Amendment groups fall here. Do they support Sakata's nomination? Do they oppose him because of his history with the ATF? Do they remain neutral on this? Sakata is no David Chipman. David Chipman, who was Biden's first choice as ATF director, former ATF agent who went to work for Giffords. There's nothing that I have seen in Sakata's past that indicates he would be a mouthpiece or that he is an anti-gun ideologue. In fact, from what I've seen in his, months as deputy director, Sakata has been, a change agent, along with Leiter. We're going to implement some of these reforms. I think the federal shutdown kind of slowed things down a bit. But I do expect that we are going to see more reforms announced in the not too distant future. Sakata may come under some questioning for Patrick Tate Adomiak. In fact, I hope that Sakata will be questioned about the ATF's treatment of Patrick Tate Adomiak, a Navy sailor who is currently serving a 20-year prison sentence for allegedly possessing and selling restricted arms that were not actually functional arms at all, according to his defense attorneys. I would like to see Mr. Sakata questioned about that, but I do expect that he is going to have a fair amount of support on Capitol Hill, and certainly, again, the backing of President Trump will go a long way among Republicans in the Senate. So we'll keep our eyes on his nomination, and I don't think any confirmation hearings have been announced. Again, his nomination was just announced today, so over the next few weeks, I expect that Sakata will be making the rounds on Capitol Hill, introducing himself to members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. That will be the committee that will take the first crack at Sakata's confirmation. And then if it clears the Senate Judiciary Committee, the nomination would head to the Senate floor for approval. So we'll keep our eyes on that development on the ATF front. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there. A story that I wrote about at Bearing Arms yesterday. A woman who's riding on Chicago's Blue Line train, doused with an accelerant set on fire. Apparently nobody came to her aid on that train car, by the way. And as it turns out, the individual who's not yet officially been charged, but he is being questioned and I guess is considered a suspect by the Chicago PD, according to CWB Chicago, back in August, knocked a psych ward employee unconscious, and then a judge decided to let him walk the streets, according to court documents. Yeah. And it is as bad as the headline. He was arrested and charged in August with aggravated battery causing great bodily harm after he knocked a female social worker unconscious while being held in a suburban psychiatric hospital. In a detention petition filed 3 days after the incident, prosecutors said he struck the woman about the face with an open hand, causing the victim pain and loss of consciousness. The victim, who was on duty and working at the time, suffered, quote, extreme nausea, severe pain in the eye and head, difficulty with balance, likely as optic nerve bruising and a concussion that caused her to experience memory issues, headaches, and daily nausea. Despite that, a judge rejected the prosecution's petition to keep this individual behind bars and instead send him home on electronic monitoring. CWB Chicago reports that the court clerk's notes describe the monitoring as 24/7, but a document signed by the judge actually authorized this individual to leave his home between 6 a.m. and 2 p.m. on weekdays. And less than 3 weeks after that, another judge modified the electronic monitoring conditions, allowing him to be out of his home during additional daylight hours on Tuesdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. Doesn't matter in this case. He would have been violating the terms of his release. This attack happened about 9:30 Monday night. But, you know, as we've talked about before, these ankle monitors, sure, they monitor where you are. But, A, you're not actively being monitored by a human being a lot of times, right? So even if an alert goes off and, you know, you're somewhere where you're not supposed to be, that doesn't mean that anybody's paying attention. It certainly doesn't mean that, you know, a be on the lookout alert's going to be sent out. At most, it is something that can lead to additional charges once you've been arrested. And of course, Chicago Transit Authority property is it's all a gun-free zone. Doesn't matter if you have a valid concealed carry license, you are not allowed to carry on buses, trains, at train stations. And violent crime in these locations is endemic. I mean, there are armed robberies, there are assaults, there are horrific incidents like this that are taking place. And Chicagoans and visitors with a valid Illinois carry license cannot exercise their right to bear arms in these locations. There is a court case called Schoenthal versus Rowell. It's actually made its way up to the Supreme Court. District judge said, yeah, this ban's unconstitutional. And then the Seventh Circuit reversed that decision, said, oh, no, it's fine, because essentially they said it is constitutional to ban the carrying of firearms in any crowded public space, which is absolutely absurd and is a direct contradiction of what the Supreme Court said in Bruin, that the city of New York, for instance, could not declare the entire island of Manhattan a sensitive place because it's crowded and a lot of people live there. Well, that was essentially the logic deployed by the Seventh Circuit to say, yeah, Chicago can ban, and the state of Illinois can ban lawful carry on public transportation because, you know, there are a lot of people there. It's a crowded and closed space. Okay. That doesn't keep out violent criminals. It's not like there's any special police presence in these locations. So you're telling me that just because there might be other people around, I lose my ability to protect myself, even though we know those other people around aren't going to come to my aid. Somebody can be set on fire, and they're not going to come to that person's aid. So I can't protect myself. Nobody else is around to protect me, and violent criminals can violate the law, and they don't have to worry about consequences if they get caught. No. I am hopeful that the Supreme Court is going to hear this case. The cert petition has been filed. Attorney General Kwame Raoul in Illinois, I think, has yet to issue his reply brief. Then there'll be another response by the plaintiffs. And then hopefully this case will be considered in conference. You know, the odds of the Supreme Court taking any particular case are pretty long. They've already granted cert to 2 Second Amendment cases. They may want to let this one percolate. I hope that they don't. Because, again, these carry prohibitions impact millions of Americans who are dependent on public transportation. If they cannot exercise their right to carry, when they're getting around from point A to point B, they can't exercise the right to carry before they get on that train or bus, after they get on that train or bus. They are deprived of their right to carry throughout their day. Meanwhile, somebody who has a private car to get around, not subject to those prohibitions. I think not only does it violate the Second Amendment, I would argue, and maybe not from a legal perspective, but certainly from a pragmatic perspective, it puts citizens on a different playing field, right? If you can afford a private vehicle, if you can afford to own your own car in Chicago, well, you get to exercise your right to carry in a lot more places than if you can't. Or if you just want to be a good steward for the environment and use public transportation to reduce your carbon footprint. That should not be reason enough to deprive you of a fundamental civil right. And unfortunately, according to the Seventh Circuit, it is. Today's armed citizen story, speaking of private vehicles, Atlanta, Georgia, where a would-be robber has been identified after being killed in a gunfight at the DeKalb County gas station. Oh, by the way, I should mention, I got so upset talking about the public transportation ban. So why is this a recidivist report? Well, in addition to the guy being charged in August and then being let loose, according to CWB Chicago, he has 53 previous criminal cases filed against him in Cook County since 1993, including 9 felonies, mostly drug-related, all of which resulted in guilty pleas, only 2 of which led to any jail time. But also in 2022, he pleaded guilty to setting, quote, a sizable fire that damaged the exterior of a government building in the Loop in Chicago. A judge sentenced him to 2 years of, quote, mental health probation, whatever that is. While on that probation, he was arrested 3 times for misdemeanors, including 2x for battery. Prosecutors dropped all of those cases, however, and he completed his probation satisfactorily. Again, absurd. CWB Chicago also reports that over the weekend, somebody matching the suspect's general description set a fire outside of City Hall. Again, don't know that it was this guy, but seems kind of suspicious. Dozens of opportunities to treat this individual with the seriousness that he deserves. And it sounds like in none of those cases did that happen. All right, now on to today's armed citizen story from the Atlanta, Georgia area, where a would-be robber has been identified after being killed in a gunfight at a DeKalb County gas station. This happened, I believe, a Monday night. 2 armed individuals targeting a guy as he leaves the store and is headed back to his car. They shot at him, not realizing that the customer was also armed. He drew his firearm, fired back in self-defense. Struck and killed 19-year-old Tristan Mays. The second robber took off into the darkness and has not been identified or arrested at this point. The victim was shot in the arm, thankfully, that wound not considered life-threatening. And police say he is expected to fully recover and will not be facing any charges because, again, he was acting in self-defense. And the police say, you know, might be a crowded public space, depending on how many people are at that gas station. And, you know, flammable material around. Should we ban concealed carry gas stations, too? I probably should not give the anti-gunners that idea, but I'm glad that the state of Georgia has not done so. Finally, today, our good deed of the day. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Abilene, Texas, who lost his motorcycle, but helped save some lives. So he considers that to be a trade well worth it. Ace Hurd is this gentleman's name. It's back on November 15th. Hurd just got his bike out of the shop. He's driving home, and he sees a car overturned on the side of the road. So he pulls over, parks his bike, runs over. He said there were some other people standing there. I asked one of them if they could help me open the back hatch of this car, which, again, is overturned at this point, right? He said, we got the hatch open. I crawled inside. We opened the driver's side door, which was up in the air at that point. I said we had somebody climb on top of the car, and I just handed the kid out. And I handed the pug out. So there was a dog, there was a child, there was an adult woman inside the vehicle. All of whom were able to get free thanks to Hurd's actions and the actions of other bystanders. But while Hurd was doing all of this, somebody plowed into his bike and totaled it. Police officer said that the driver reported he didn't see the headlights on the bike until it was too late. Hurd says, you know, it was worth it. He said, it's a material item. That's replaceable. He said, if I would have kept going to protect my bike and then I heard on the news that somebody died in that accident, he said, I would feel guilty. That's somebody's life. You can't replace that. My bike can always be replaced. Heard is kept in touch with the mom and child, who are both okay. Hopefully insurance will, you know, you can't rebuild the bike, but hopefully it will replace the bike. And as Heard says, you know, that is a material possession. Sucks to lose it, but saving a life, yeah, that's a good trade, right? So in the right place at the right time, we'll be able to do the right thing. Ace Heard and the other Good Samaritans there in Abilene, Texas, we thank you for your very, very good deed. Now, that is all the time we've got for you on this edition of Marion Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We will be talking with Knox Williams from the American Suppressor Association. And in the meantime, you know, I'd encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, VIP Platinum member. We've got our sale going on right now. Use the promo code FIGHT. Get 60% off of your membership, no matter what tier of support you choose. You're going to get some great benefits. If you do choose VIP Gold or Platinum, though, you get to take part, among other things, you get to take part in our weekly live chats. We do it every Wednesday, 1:30 Eastern, Hot Airs at Morrissey, myself. It's my favorite hour of the work week. Love hanging out with our VIP Gold and Platinum members. Would love for you to be a part of that experience as well. Again, just go to BarionArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off of your membership, no matter what tier of support you choose. And again, no matter what tier of support you choose, thank you for supporting the work that we're doing here at Barion Arms. It really, truly does make a difference, and it is greatly appreciated. All right. Have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. We'll see you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.